Welcome to Amped Up, Utility Insights, Trends and Challenges. I'm your host, Melissa Parvis, CEO of Athena, a consultancy and workforce solutions provider operating in the utility sector. In this podcast, we explore the ever-changing landscape of US electric utilities with great minds and insightful conversations. The US electric power industry is facing a major problem right now, and this is due to the unprecedented demand in electricity caused by data center growth, electric vehicles, industrial manufacturing needs, and heating pumps, just to name a few of the major culprits. And this problem is exacerbated by the fact that we are operating in a highly regulated industry with unprecedented transmission interconnection queues and supply chain issues. However, my next guest is highly knowledgeable in this area, and he's thought of an ingeniously simple way to maybe not solve the entire problem, but certainly lighten the load, if you're pardoning the pun. Thank you so much, Tyler Norris, for joining us. Tyler, if you could give us a little bit more of an insight into your background and your experience in this area.
Yeah, sure thing. Well, thanks so much for having me. I've been in the energy space for about 15 years now, and I started at the U.S. Department of Energy, actually in Secretary of Energy Chu's office when he was serving under Obama. And I primarily focused on technology to market and tech transfer issues. And I was there, so we were trying to figure out how do you get more, you know, intellectual property and technologies out of the national laboratories and the universities into the marketplace. And so I did that for a little while. I kind of caught the electricity bug, as they say, after that, and ended up at S&P Global Platts doing their North American electricity market outlook. And then from there, got impatient as the markets were shifting so quickly, especially with the rise of large-scale solar and storage. So I decided to join a developer, Cypress Creek Renewables, where I spent about 5 years, became vice president there. And a lot of what I ended up working on there was these regulatory proceedings where we were trying to, you know, establish the rate structure and the PPA terms and the interconnection procedures and all of these issues that govern the electric power sector. And a lot of what you do in those proceedings is, you know, you work with these super smart kind of modelers and consultants to develop like electricity simulation models, and really love that work. It was actually part of my job that I enjoyed the most. And so I concluded if I could go a little deeper and sharpen my analytical tools with a PhD in electric power systems, that I could maybe be more valuable and on some of these issues. So I ended up at Duke University at the Nicholas School focusing on that.
Excellent. And now you're pursuing your PhD at Duke, right? In power systems.
That's right.
Excellent. So this white paper that you wrote is causing quite a stir. I'd like to start by taking a quick quote from the white paper to start our discussion. The quote is, "Overall, these results suggest the U.S. power system's existing headroom resulting from intentional planning decisions is sufficient to accommodate significant constant new loads and has the potential for leveraging flexible load as a complement to supply-side investments, enabling growth while mitigating the need for large expenditures on new capacity." So here are you saying that the grid was intentionally built to have reserves for unforeseen peak demand, and an unexpected benefit of this is flexible demand can now help accommodate the rising electricity needs we have today and the immediate need for new generation or transmission.
Yeah, you know, it's almost counterintuitive because we hear so often that, you know, the system has no available headroom, and that's why we need to dramatically expand transmission and generation. And we certainly do need to invest in more transmission and generation. But the fact of the matter is we plan the whole system around these occasional extreme swings in demand, particularly during extreme weather systems in the winter or summer. So the whole system is planned around these sort of extreme peaks. And during the vast majority of hours in the year, the demand on the system is much lower than that peak. What that effectively means is that there's actually a lot of room to add more load on most of the power grid, as long as that new load doesn't put additional stress during these extreme system peaks. And actually, in the paper, we actually discount all the reserve margins. So you have these existing system peaks, right? On top of those peaks, you have reserve margin. So every system planner is ensuring their system can meet their max realized peak demands, plus like the possibility of even higher demand, but also accounting for potential unplanned outages in generators, you know, and or transmission. So it turns out, I mean, we have a lot of, we've already expended a lot of money on this existing system, and we're going to need to expand it. But there is this possibility that we could add a lot of new load if that load can have some degree of flexibility. And just really quick, you know, when we say flexibility, it's like, well, what do we mean? That first and foremost could be, you know, they have their own on-site power storage, right? So maybe they have a big battery system. Maybe they do have their own natural gas generator or another mix of renewables, right, that they could tap. It could be that they're able to temporarily shift, say, a computational load either a couple hours before or after the system peak is expected, or they're able to shift that computational load from one data center to another that's located in a different area, or in some cases, they, especially if they have planned maintenance they need to do anyway or planned downtime, or they could simply reduce their operations during these kind of short windows. And that's what we do see happen with crypto mining, right? I mean, they're able to ramp down very, very quickly in response to demand response signals.
Mm. So what you're saying is your white paper analyzes and proves through analysis and data that the grid doesn't necessarily need to be expanded, but a large part of it can be made to be more efficient so that we can maintain affordability and reliability, and also these meet these increased needs and demands for electricity. Is that right?
Yeah, and you know, we try to be very clear that we don't want the paper to be interpreted to suggest that, you know, there shouldn't be investment in more transmission or generation. There are a lot of reasons to do that, because there is a lot of load growth from a variety of different sectors, and there's also just a need to get access the more generation in certain locations, right, where we just have a lot more resource potential, right, especially in renewable energy rich zones. But the general point is that, look, we're in this race to try to connect these new loads, the new data centers, new factories. This is important for a whole host of reasons. And if that's a priority, right, to connect the new loads as quickly as reasonably possible and get them up and running, we have the ability to do that to the extent that those new loads can offer some flexibility to the system. Mm. I mean, to offer one other perspective on, you know, the flexibility doesn't necessarily have to come from the new loads. You could have existing load offering this flexibility too. And that's kind of this whole concept of virtual power plants, or just what we generally call demand response. And so there's a lot of promise there. And there's a lot of efforts to try to aggregate existing loads into virtual power plants. It's tricky, right? Because you have to go and sign up, right, thousands, sometimes thousands of different customers, right, under one program, and coordinate all of that to make sure that, you know, they're gonna flex their load during these system peaks. That there's a lot of promise there, but there may also be a lot of promise in doing it where you have these new mega loads, right, where it's one centralized operator might offer this ability to capture that flexibility more quickly and more readily.
I see. And how can these load strategies help accelerate interconnection processes?
This is, I think, really the tip of the spear and what we're hearing in terms of interest from some of these large loads and data centers in particular, and why they have potential interest in offering this flexibility, is that they may allow them to get on the grid more quickly. And the basic reason for that is when you do an interconnection study for either a new load or a new generator, what you generally do is you assume that it's either injecting or it's withdrawing at 100% of its maximum rated capacity. And you assume that that's happening on the existing system peak. And this is what's prone to cause significant overloads on the system and trigger the need for significant expansion and transmission capacity. And so if instead that load is able to not put more stress during that system peak, and has some flexibility to offer and may be able to shave multiple years. I mean, in some cases, I mean, some of these long lead upgrades where you're talking about, you know, potentially dozens of miles of, you know, thermal reconductoring from major transmission lines. I mean, they might be able to shave 5+ years off their interconnection time frame. It's going to depend exactly where they are on the grid and what the contingent upgrade is. But because, right, there's such this big emphasis on speed to market, right, because there's such a breakneck competition to get these new facilities online, this may be one of the kind of key value adds in the near term. And the other thing I'll just say about it is that that could be a temporary arrangement. Right. So it could just be that that new load could be offering that flexibility only until the network has been expanded, the transmission and the generation has been installed such that it can be serviced with 100% firm service. And so this could be temporary or what we'd call like a provisional service arrangement.
I see. So among the need for increased electricity for EVs, data centers, electric heat pumps, amongst other items as well, what currently is causing the biggest significant increase in demand for electricity needs?
Yeah. Well, as you know, and as you mentioned, right, there are several sectors that are contributing to load growth, and we've known about those for a while. You know, they're not particularly surprising, but what's caused the biggest shift in the load forecasts over the past 12 to 18 months, I think, is, well, certainly new factories, right, that have announced their intentions to site in certain locations and primarily resulting from the Inflation Reduction Act. That is material. But the even bigger factor has been, right, just the rapid growth of AI and the emergence of these AI specialized hyperscale data centers, right, at multi-hundred megawatt or in some cases, right, they're even talking about, you know, over a gigawatt scale facilities. And it's emerged so quickly that, you know, in some of the higher end forecasts suggest that data centers could represent 44% of U.S. electricity load growth through 2028. Obviously, uncertainty introduced by DeepSeek. So we'll see where that lands. And as we, you know, we sort of say in the report, if you have uncertainty around that load growth figure for the data centers, what you want are tools that can kind of hedge against that uncertainty, especially as a regulator, if you're considering large expenditures on new generation and transmission capacity. And so flexibility, right, is like one of the tools on the toolboxes that you could use to enable the load to get online, but hedge against the need for premature investment in new capacity.
So many of our listeners are utility professionals and some might not be. So to frame this conversation, I think it would be very helpful to get a quick definition of load factor and why it's so important in terms of load growth.
Yeah, thanks. It's a key concept for our paper. I think it is for everyone that's thinking about load growth right now. And so technically, like, load factor just means for any given load, what's the average demand that it has over a given period of time divided by its maximum realized demand over that period of time. So if a data center operated in all hours at 100% of its maximum draw, then, you know, its load factor would be 100%. But you can think about this in terms of at a system level, right? So at a whole balancing authority level or for an RTO, ISO. And it turns out that the load factors for our systems are probably lower than you would expect. So we ran this for 22 balancing authorities representing 95% of the country's peak load. And the average load factor for the 22 systems was 53%. And so what that means is that in approximately half the time, most of our available generation and transmission capacity is underutilized, right? And this kind of makes sense intuitively, right? You think about, obviously, load ramps down during the night and during the shoulder months in the spring and the fall. But the general takeaway is that in most hours of the year, again, right, there is available headroom, and you can quantify that in terms of the load factor.
Makes sense. So you also introduced in this white paper this concept of curtailment-enabled headroom. Could you explain a bit more exactly of what that means?
Yeah, Yeah, so this is it's kind of a different way of thinking about load growth. So, you know, usually you'd say, well, a given balancing authority to accommodate new load, it would have to add, right, X amount of generation capacity and transmission capacity. When we think about it in terms of curtailment-enabled headroom, what you're asking is how much new load could a given system accommodate if that new load were to offer a given level of flexibility to the system? Mm. And specifically, what portion of its maximum potential consumption in a given year would it be willing to offer or for curtailment?
Right.
Meaning it would be, so we looked at this at a few different thresholds, right, to look at how does the curtailment-enabled headroom change as the volume of curtailment changes. We looked at 0.25%, 0.5%, 1%, and 5% to be consistent with existing demand response programs and the high uptime requirements of the data centers. And what we found is that even at, you know, a very, I mean, some people would call it a very low amount, you might say modest of 0.25 or 0.5%, the available headroom is fairly substantial. At 0.25%, it's 76 gigawatts, according to this analysis, on a national scale, and it's about 100 gigawatts at 0.5%. And, you know, we say very clearly in the report, this is a first order analysis. And once you make it more granular for a given system, there are factors that could pull it up or down. And we go through those details in the limitations section. But that's the concept. And that's the general scale of what we're talking about here in terms of possible headroom.
I see. And between all of the different balancing authorities that you you looked at, was there a difference between RTO or ISO markets and non-RTO regions?
Yeah, the amount of headroom ends up kind of aligning with one's intuitions just based on kind of the size of the markets. And so what we found is that the highest amount of headroom was in primarily the largest ISO RTO. So you would expect PJM, of course, being kind of the number one. MISO is number two, ERCOT number three, then Southwest Power Pool, SPP. And then, you know, interestingly, the fifth largest was Southern Company, which is the owner and operator of three investor owned utilities in the Southeast. That's Georgia Power, Mississippi Power, and Alabama Power.
Okay. There's a lot of buzz right now around data center flexibility. And I would like to know, in your experience, what are the obstacles from preventing those data centers from fully participating in demand response programs?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, for over 15 years now, there's been interest in the possibility of more flexibility from computational loads, and in part just because there's such precision controlled systems. And so there's a whole body of literature on this. And I think it's fair to say that that hope has not been met to date in terms of the amount of participation by data centers and demand response programs. There is some participation. We document some of the examples. You know, Google has several data centers that participate in demand response, and NLX facilitates demand response for a variety of data centers, but it's not as high as I think some expected. And I think a lot of that just relates to the very high uptime guarantees that the data center operators offer to their customers through these service arrangements. And also just the nature of these existing kind of inference loads are kind of, they're really real-time services for cloud computing. And given the kind of uncertain nature of, right, like real-time demand, I think that's another reason we haven't seen as much uptake. But part of what we do in the paper is kind of walk through why there's this new wave of interest in data center flexibility that has emerged because of a variety of recent changes. And so one of those is the rise of the training loads, which are more schedulable and deferrable than these legacy, you know, real-time cloud computing type loads. The other is the emergence of just advanced computational load management techniques, including both temporal and kind of spatial flexibility, and then just the development and the options for on-site power, right? Obviously, the cost of battery storage has come way down the cost curve. You have the emergence of other on-site options that go beyond this kind of traditional reliance on these relatively dirty kind of tier two diesel generators. And then just this broader shift in the market, right, where we're now very tight on capacity market prices are rising quite quickly, and we just have a lot of supply chain bottlenecks.
I see. Well, I'd like to take the conversation in a little bit of a different direction now and talk a bit about generator interconnection. How can innovative interconnection strategies like those drawing on FERC Order 2003 facilitate the co-location of new generation with large loads?
Yeah, it's interesting because what we're talking about here is pretty relevant to an existing option for large generators to connect to the grid. And this goes all the way back to FERC Order 2003 and the year 2003 when they first created interconnection service. And we have two fundamental types of interconnection service. One is for capacity resources and the other is for energy resources. And for energy resources, the idea is that they should be able to connect to the grid in a much faster and cheaper way because they don't get treated as capacity resources that receive capacity compensation, and they might be subject to occasional curtailment during congestion events. And we've seen this really play out, especially in ERCOT, right? So in Texas, it's an energy-only electricity market. All of their new generators are treated as energy-only, and so they're able to connect much faster and much more cheaply than on average in the rest of the country. And that's kind of similar to what we're talking about here in terms of this interruptible or flexible load service that might enable faster and cheaper interconnection, or at least sort of on a provisional basis until that firm capacity becomes available. So there are a lot of interesting nuances around the way that energy-only interconnection is treated outside of ERCOT.
I see.
Kind of suffice to say that it hasn't been as optimized, I think, as perhaps FERC originally intended. And so we're working on some additional research on that topic and trying to develop ways to kind of streamline that service. But I think it offers kind of a model that we could use here if we were to put it onto the load side.
What are the any other policy or regulatory changes that you think should be implemented or maybe are going to be implemented to encourage utilities and data center managers to embrace the flexible load strategies?
Yeah, you know, we've been asked, how does this compare to existing demand response programs? And just as an aside, you know, there's quite substantial contribution from some demand response programs. And MISO, for example, you know, 10% of their peak load is met by demand response. So what's different, I think, about this is that, you know, a lot of the loads that participate in existing demand response programs, they were planned as fully firm loads, meaning reserve margin and transmission was planned to service them in a fully firm manner. And then they decided to participate in the demand response program because of the economic incentive. But what we're talking about here is much more in the planning realm, where you're trying to pull all this kind of earlier in the decision-making process so that you can acknowledge a new load's flexibility capability and then plan the system in response, both for generation and transmission. And that's kind of interesting because we've had what we call integrated resource planning now for a few decades in some jurisdictions. And only very recently did we say, we need to get much better at proactive transmission planning and multi-value transmission planning and sort of pull that up into a type of integrated resource planning process. And now we're saying, especially with these massive new loads coming in, we need to get smarter about planning the system in response to their capabilities. And so it is a slightly different paradigm for how to how to plan the system. We're seeing some examples of it already emerge. ERCOT has this controllable load resource service that they've introduced and are using for more flexible loads. And we see this example, PG&E has this new Flex Connect program in California that's somewhat similar. But this is going to require, you know, regulators leaning in a little bit here, and I think just getting their arms a little bit more around how to integrate load planning upfront into those planning processes.
Mm. Well, if any listeners want a deeper delve into Tyler's concepts that he's introduced into his white paper, I'm going to put a link to the white paper down below so it's easily accessible. Tyler, any final words of wisdom for listeners out there trying to navigate this new era of load growth?
We're all learning, right? We're all catching up because this is, the capabilities have evolved so quickly here. And so I think even a few months ago, right, the prevailing wisdom was that data centers are 100% inflexible.
Yeah.
They have 100% load factor and there's not much we can do about it. But there's now, I think, reason to suspect that we are going to see some changes there. And we all have to kind of stay up to speed on the literature, on the capabilities, and keep learning and sort of incorporating these new technologies.
Thank you, Tyler. It's been a pleasure having you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Amped Up. If you like this conversation, please support this content. Subscribe and rate the show on YouTube, Apple Podcast, or Spotify.